Accession number 17561, Reel 2.
Colonel Jarvis, Reel 2.
While we were resting at Alamein one night, we were very badly bombed that night and in the following day by Stukas. And it's the first time I saw my men being killed, just dying on a stretcher. One had his leg blown off, and I met him nearly 50 years later in the Wirral. No bitterness. He spent 2 years being repaired, and he got a job with the water company. His wife, very proud of him. And we had this wonderful reunion up there. One bomb didn't go off. I was told to demolish it, dispose of it. I knew I was quite safe because I'd read somewhere that small bombs, 50 or 100 kilogram bombs, never had any anti-lifting devices in them. So we cleared the area and blew it up. After about 10 or 12 days, the order came through for the last final push called Operation Supercharge, which was a complete mixture of all the units, all, as far as I can see, the New Zealanders, Indians, and some of ours, and we were told to put in a battalion of ours to try and take Woodcock again with another battalion of the Sussex Regiment, where one had been lost 7 days before. And off we went. I had to go with about six sappers with haversacks full of explosives, again to destroy any knocked out tanks or guns on the way. And it worked perfectly. We got there just in time, the start line. Thought we were going to miss the time. And off we went following this barrage. Got onto the objective, just behind the barrage, found it was full of Italians this time, who surrendered, hundreds of them, surrendered. Rather pitiful sight, actually, all showing trying to, in the moonlight and the dark, trying to show us photographs of their families and things, saying, you know, well, they wanted to be let off. And my job was to walk back then, absolutely worn out. One thing I do remember, I had a lance sergeant with me, a very highly educated chap who was commissioned later on. Remember, as we trudged back there and the airburst shrapnels going on over our heads, saying, "Isn't this stupid, the whole business? Shooting all this high explosive at each other in the desert." He was, yeah, how stupid the whole thing was. But anyway, he got a military medal, actually, Parks. I got back, reported to Peter Moore. I said, "I think the Boche have had it, but we don't seem to be getting through." Because just before I left at dawn, I could see our tanks being shot up, this Operation Supercharge, with very, very brave charges by some Yeomanry regiments, the Warwickshire Yeomanry and the Wiltshire Yeomanry. You see them being picked off. You see, one 88mm gun, given time, could cover 2 miles of front, 1 mile either way, and go through any of our tanks at that range. But they kept on going, and apparently they got through. But I got back with my men and fell asleep. And early in the morning, I was woken up by a dispatch rider from Peter Moore with a torch, and he handed me a message written out from 3 Field Squadron, 2, 1 Troop, 2 Troop, 3 Troop. And the words were, "Indications, enemy withdrawal. Join affiliated battalions, First Light, move west." Couldn't believe it. I joined my battalions and we drove off that morning, and there was the no signs of any battle, quiet battlefield, but desert. As we got in, there were just hundreds, thousands of battalions surrendering, and all their weapons, they had no fight in them at all. We'd won.
What state were you in by then?
Well, we were very pleased with ourselves. In fact, we had already done this big minefield breaching operation. I think we had less casualties than the tanks or the infantry. Half the infantry had gone, and most of the tanks, the division was split up. It went back, the skeleton went back to Syria to reform. We were detached and used as a spare field squadron by the chief engineer of the 8th Army. We were sent to Tobruk, first job was to clear the road along from Batroux, make sure there were no debris, and then right out of the way. Went to Tobruk, where we tried to get the harbour going and some water supply going. We had Christmas there, quite a good one.
What was the harbour like at Tobruk?
We tried to make landing, not too bad, one or two sunken ships. We tried to make landing jetties so the Ithami could be supplied. There are very few harbours you see along the North African coast. But once they got past Benghazi, that was a better port. I think Tobruk wasn't so important. And then just after Christmas, we were ordered forward to rejoin the 8th Army. Spare field squadron, no division, no brigade, all on our own. The only ones wearing the 10th Armoured Division sign, which was the fox's mask, the hunting mask, you know, the yeomanry and cavalry and what. And we kept on going, and Tripoli fell the 23rd of January 1943, and we thought we'd be sent into Tripoli to do some odd jobs there, instead of which we bypassed Tripoli, put under command of the Infantry Brigade of the 7th Armoured Division, whose job was to push back the remnants of the Africa Corps back into Tunisia, because it was quite impossible to mount any big operation until the port of Tripoli was open, right on the end of a 1,000-mile LFC, you see. And so quite suddenly I found myself in the leading vehicle of the 8th Army. All very keen we were to get back into operations, which was our job. We weren't all that good at the water supply, the technical side and all that. We were field sappers. And suddenly found myself the leading jeep, leading scout car, under command of 131 Lloyd Infantry Brigade of the Queens, all Queens battalions, commanded by Brigadier Whistler. And the job was to clear the road. And the Germans had gone back from Tripoli across the salt marshes, cratering the road, putting mines in the craters and mines in the verges. And all we had to do was just keep going westwards. And it was quite grim, actually. We averaged about 4 miles a day, filling in these craters and getting these mines out. Very, very few casualties to start with. And we pushed on. I remember the second in command captain coming up to tell me, he's got bad news for you. Your Corporal Bill Porter has been killed. He's the one who walked with me, my little party, Alamein, brave as could be, the recce party to find the minefields. He'd been killed disarming a mine, anti-tank mine, which is most unusual, because he's usually pretty safe. Anyway, his section carried on under the Lance Corporal. I was given an officer to help me, because this was the most important job in the army, I'd have thought, for a young officer. I was given another job, officer sent to help me, and he turned out to be the officer, the cadet, who'd shared a room with me at Woolwich. Great friends, actually. The two of us ran this thing between us, and meant if some went out at night, the other chap could have a rest, you see. He was killed later on by an S mine. These S mines were caught all the trouble, these ones that jumped. They were made rather beautifully made, looked like the oil filter of a car, with a little three prongs on top. And if it was touched, there was a few seconds delay, and then it jumped. And as it went up, it exploded almost immediately at breast height, throwing ball bearings out, and it could bring down people over a wide range. We got into Tunisia. An attack was made on Ben Gardam. The enemy had flown. And we pushed on and on. We're getting a little bit ragged, a bit untidy now. And one day I was resting with my troop, and I heard a day, nothing much happening. I heard an explosion. Shell, I thought. No sound of a gun. And some minutes later up came the OC, my new OC's scout car, with the driver saying, come quick. The OC and Captain, whatever his name is, were being killed. I went back. They wandered into a minefield, the two of them. Could resist the temptation when we found a German minefield of looking into it to see, what's the boss been up to this time? You know, oh, we cope with that. One of them had set off an S mine. They were both killed immediately. captain had been wounded that day by a shell, so I suddenly found myself commanding the squadron, 200 men. And I sat in the office truck and realised then that of the 9 officers we had at Alamein, 8 plus 1 attached, there are now only 2 left. Myself and one other. And the chief engineer came, he was great help. The CRE of the 7th Armoured Division came, he was a great help. People are much more businesslike and kinder in operations than they are when you're training in peacetime. It's more like a business you've got to get done between you. And then a UOC came. One thing which might interest you, while I sat in that truck wondering just what was happening, a message came in from the 7th Armoured Division to 3 Field Squadron saying, splice the main brace. I didn't know what it meant. I was so young. Some of the clerk eventually told me, he said, I think it's something to do with rum. I didn't know at all. Eventually we found the quartermaster had two jars of rum to be issued only on order of the division. And this was dished out to the men. I didn't have mine. I didn't like the stuff at all. So a new OC came.
What were you toasting? What were you celebrating?
Oh no, this was to restore morale. The great thing in the war was rum. The First World War, a lot of rum issues to keep people's pecker up, you know. But it had to be limited, otherwise people would help themselves every night. This thing was orders of division only. New OC came, and we were now getting near the end. We got up to the Marath line. I remember the abortive attack by the Guards Brigade on Horseshoe Hill, quite near to us, where they ran into a very badly mined defensive position. Couldn't get their supporting weapons up. One or two people got on the objective, guardsmen fired the success signal, and the supporting anti-tank guns ran onto the minefield. There's a lot been written about this, Horseshoe Hill, how the guards, we had a terrible time there. A preliminary battle to the Battle of Marath. Battle of Marath went in. We all thought it was going to be easy. It wasn't. It was very badly planned, apparently, on too narrow a front, and it failed. On the Wadi Zigzaw, I think it was, the 50th Division failed, and all they fought very bravely. One of the OCs got a VC. That was called off. And the outflanking force of the New Zealanders got right round to the west of the Matmata Hills, was reinforced by the 1st Armoured Division and the 8th Armoured Brigade to get right round and try to cut off the Africa Corps. I was told to join that. I thought, what's the point of me, my sappers, joining the Taylor column like that 100 miles away? We wouldn't be any use at all. That was abandoned. The order was cancelled. And I was told instead to report to a brigade of the 4th Indian Division, who were going to do an attack through them at Matmata Hills to shorten the LOC to this outflanking force. And this was more like it. I saw put under command of a battalion of the Rajput Battalion of Rifles, and we knew exactly what we had to do. We had to get through those hills. We were told the enemy opposition would be light. Another company, a very good skilled company of sappers, repaired the road. It had all been demolished with all the compressors all through the night. And next morning, off we went. I led on my jeep, a lot of sandbags. I was quite confident I could find any mines on the dry track, quite confident. Myself on the jeep, sandbags on the bonnet, sandbags on the bumper, sandbags on the driver's feet. A troop of sappers behind me, and a company of infantry, and the rest of my troop, and the rest of the battalion. And on we went through the Matmata Hills. I came across a lone Tunisian gesticulating, who said, "No mines here," and a bit of French. "I'll show you where they are." And he got dumped in the jeep and went on a little bit faster, still a bit carefully. And he said, "There they are," and we could see the mines quite clearly, where the retreating enemy had laid them in this track, quite conspicuous actually. Clear that in no time, pushed on. The hills are now getting very, very steep. And the idea was the infantry brigade would turn north up through the Matmata Hills. And for some reason I got off my front of my jeep, went to look around the corner, and there were the enemy. battalions, all in their green uniforms. So I ran back very quickly to the company commander, who got in touch with his battalion commander, who I met later on at the staff college, incidentally. And the battalion company was of the battalion was deployed. Marvellous sight seeing these were very smart infantry, Indian infantry, all their small packs and helmets and rifles of the high port. And they just, as they swooped down onto the Italians, white flags went up. They had no intention of firing, of fighting. Very different story later on. They were ambushed. Some of the Indians were ambushed further north by Germans. They were shot at very badly. We were lucky to get away with that. And then the plan was, all arranged by the chief engineer, for a detachment of the long-range desert group to escort us to go right over to the axis of the New Zealanders while the infantry, Indian infantry, turned north. So we just drove west, no sign of any enemy. The last thing at night, I saw an armoured car which worried us, and we leaguered and kept awake, and we were through fine. I lost one sapper only on that, repairing the minefield and coming back, widening the gap and putting up proper signs and things. There must have been one S mine just outside the track, and he was killed. Brand new sapper reinforcement. I felt awful over that sapper Smith. Smoked the whole darn thing.
Which month is this?
This was March 43. Anyway, the Germans were defeated at Alhama by the New Zealanders and our 1st Armoured Division, and withdrew to the Wadi Akrit. Well, we were spare now. We were put on to odd jobs, water supply, guarding prisoners, which was not a usual job for sappers. And then I was told to go and rest in a town in Tunisia, I've forgotten his name now, and to make fascines, just to give us something to do, because the fascines were missing at the Marath battle. They got bogged down in the wadi, which was very damp. This was locking the stable door after the horse had gone. I think they're thinking, hey, we did this before. Anyway, I got a bit fed up with that. The French supplied the materials, the French officer there in a very smart uniform, I remember. And I thought, well, this is better than nothing, just we'll recover. Perhaps they'll find a job for us. And suddenly we heard that the Battle of Akrit had been won. On the 5th of April, 43, a surprise attack was put in by the 8th Army on the advice of the 4th Indian Divisional Commander, Tucker. Instead of having the usual business for preparations and barrages, let's go in very quickly with a night attack. And it worked beautifully. And according to Montgomery, that was the hardest fighting of any troops under his command in the whole of the war, the Battle of the Akrit. Instead of saying crumbling or doing business, they went on, got right through that night. And the enemy, a slight counterattack, packed up and went right back to near Tunis in Fidaville. Wonderful news that was. And there were all rumours going around that after 2 years we'd be going home. We didn't realise we had another 2 years to go before that happened. The night after the Battle of the Akrit, a dispatch rider came to me, a liaison officer came to me direct from the chief engineer of the 8th Army, and told me to clear the crossing of the Wadi Akrit, where the main road crossed it, clear it of mines, in preparation for repair job by the New Zealand engineer, by the South African engineers. South African engineers were very good, very accomplished at this sort of pioneering work, much better than we were. So I got there very early on the morning of the 7th of April. The battle had gone, the two bridges, the railway and road, had been demolished and dropped into the Wadi Akrit. There was one officer there, South African, who warned me, said there are mines on the far side. So I prodded my way all down this wadi up the other side, and there was a minefield just to the side of the road, still with the wire up, the barbed wire, and I could see it was full of S mines. maybe others buried, and tripwires, I could see them. Well, this is going to be an absolute snorter. The troop had arrived now, brought up by the sergeant afterwards, you see. I went back to see him, and we talked about this. There was no need for any heroics for this thing. I told them we're going to clear this area very, very thoroughly. If it took days, 4 days, 6 days, 8 days, no need for it. The plenty of crossing places on the Wadi Akrit further up. My plan was to try and tape out the whole area with white tape and sweep, probably. While we were talking about this, the chief engineer of the army came up with his deputy, this Brigadier Kish, very clever Jew, very, very famous chap, before the war even, as a Zionist. His deputy, South African, full colonel, and staff officer. He jumped out of his car and he congratulated us on the battle through the McMartyr Hills. His pet Fabian came through there and he did jolly well and all this. We'll soon have the Germans beaten. And I said, there are mines on the other side, sir. Because you're still only a lieutenant. And he, let's go have a look. Because I was terrified of these senior officers. I had to take him all the way down the Wadi, up the other side. And there was this minefield. And he said, God, what have they been doing here? I could not stop him going into the minefield with his deputy and his staff officer. And what I didn't realise at the time was my own OC had arrived and had been seen rushing up on the other side through where the tripwires were. Anyway, I just stepped back to talk to my sergeant because they wouldn't know what to do. There was an explosion. S mine went off. And all four officers were killed.
Including Kish?
Yeah. All four, quite unnecessary, this business. So we went in with a rescue party. We were prodding with bandits. I remember we had the troop medical orderly there. We went in and we turned them all over, and you know, he's had it, and they were all dead. And while we were talking, lying in this little minefield, another mine went off. But this was a very small one compared. What couldn't have been an S mine? S mine was a terribly powerful thing. Maybe in a booby trapped hand grenade. Something. And we were all the members of the rescue party were wounded. Nobody killed. One had a kneecap very badly hurt. I had a tiny piece in my backside. Just lay there, absolutely horrified. And another rescue party organized by my Lance Sergeant and Anderson came in with mine detectors and cleared the whole place, got us all out, all 10 or 11 of us, without any more to do. I then realised there was nothing much wrong. I was too frightened to do it. There was nothing much wrong with me, just a tiny pellet in my backside, which the doctor took out, and I went back to the chief engineer. And after that, we were put on to repairing the harbour at Sousse for the invasion force.
What did the repairs involve at Sousse?
Clearing, they blocked the harbour. That was a question of getting that the sunken ship dragged to the side. We did with lots and lots of pulleys and tractors and things, and making a hard, usually with sandbags full of concrete, for these landing craft. You know, they have ramps, so the Highland Division could practice embarking and getting off. I think the main objective was Pantelleria from there. Pantelleria, as you know, surrendered through bombing alone. In case of that ever happening, I think, in the war, just gave in before anybody landed. We managed to see Tunis, this wonderful place, Tunis, a bit of French civilization. And then the orders came to drive back to Syria to join the 10th Armoured Division, just north of Damascus. So we drove all the way back and had a wonderful leave in Cairo. I was put up by the padre who really, I had rescued in the back of my lorry coming out of Mersa Matru. He was always very grateful. After every time you come anywhere near to Cairo, anywhere, come and I'll put you up, he said, because he had a lovely big house called the Manse, a Scots Padre, in Cairo. I was very lucky there. And then, because I was due to get my rank back, and I was sent to Cabrit to teach command operations, which I knew nothing about at all. That's how the army works. You put people in to go and teach something, learn it as you go, you know. That was a nice civilized place, Cabrit on the canal, where all the brigade groups came through to be trained. the Aegean to start with, which was a failure. You know, the Aegean, they tried to land in the eastern Mediterranean, and the Germans retaliated very quickly, and we had to come out. And they were practicing before they went to Italy for the hook and things there, Anzio. From there, I went to the Staff College in Quetta, a long staff course for a PSC, about 4 or 5 months. Shipwrecked on the way, saved by the Americans. We had an Air Force base in Aden. They flew us on.
You were shipwrecked?
Shipwrecked going to Aden, yes. It wasn't very serious, but an abandoned ship.
Not from enemy action?
No, just by navigation, I think. And we hit a rock. And then we were stuck in Aden and didn't know what to do with us. But the Americans said, the four of you go to the Star College, we'll fly you on. Very good. So they had a base there for bringing aircraft across Africa to the Burma front. I then came back as a staff captain to Italy, drove up the Rhone Valley to reinforce 21st Army Group at the end of the war, March 45. Got there just when the war ended, really. Oh, I got some leave. So after 4 years, had some leave. We all had 8 days leave after 4 years, and to get back again. And once you got there, you were deemed to be part of Rhine Army with no repatriation. You just leave only. A lot of trouble over that. Very bad management. A lot of troops who'd been 4 years abroad were told you can't go home, you have to leave only, and then you start again under the orders of the 21st Army Group. That's where that general should have put his foot down and say, right, you've been 4 years abroad, you can go home for a bit, you know. I didn't mind because I was single, free.
Did it create much discontent?
Yes, there was a lot of especially among the works units, the ones it's the ones on the LFC who usually show discontent and things. Same thing happened in Syria, the people at the back end who start getting bolshy.
Why should that be rather than the front line?
Not the same sort of spirit, is there? Not the same morale and respect for their officers and anything. It was the Army Service Corps in the Suez operation showed that.
So the discontent over leave arrangements was in Germany?
In Germany, yes. The troops who had been brought up from the Middle East with 4 years service
. What effect did the war experience have on you after the war? Did it mark you very much?
I think it must have done. First thing is one of gratitude, as I got away with it. You see, all these super fine chaps who did more than I did, a lot of them, they were the unlucky ones. I got away with it, just a scratch. They gave me an MC for the McMartyr Hill things, which is easy, really. But I suppose they couldn't do anything else, and they went left in the squadron. And the only officer left from the original, yeah, pretty well. Yes, well, the only one. I think, Secretary, think about it.